Why do Americans feel so bad about their country right now? Gary Hart, the former Colorado senator and presidential contender, argues that the answer has to do with the gap between who we believe ourselves to be and who we have become. He writes about this in his new book, The Republic of Conscience. America's founders, he tells us, created a republic knowing that it, like all republics from ancient Athens and Rome onward, would be vulnerable to corruption. Gary Hart is a former U.S. senator from Colorado, a presidential candidate, and the author of 21 books, including his Oxford doctoral dissertation on Jefferson's ideal of the republic. Again, the name of the book is The Republic of Conscience, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Senator Gary Hart to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Very nice to have you with us. What got you thinking about this in these very specific terms?
It began about 20 years ago. I had a very simple question on my mind that I should have been able to answer, and that is why, if we consider ourselves a democracy, which we are, did the founders use the language of the republic, and what did they mean by that? So I started reading literature on Athens and Rome, and then coming forward to our own founding, and they believed that we were a democracy, but that our form of government was like the ancient republic, and the importance of that is that the danger to a republic throughout history was what they called corruption. Today we would think of that as bribery, but that's not what they meant. They meant, as you said, putting special interests ahead of the common good. And if you apply that standard to Washington today, then we are a corrupt republic. We're spending over $4 billion on lobbying for special interests. Over 400 former members of Congress are now lobbyists, and campaign costs tied in with those special interests are skyrocketing. And everyday people in this country, including myself, believe that there is a network in Washington that is, if not closed to everyday Americans, at least highly resistant to their participation.
You point out in the book, when you look at what our founders did, you say that they understood exactly what they were doing when they created the nation, and they intentionally set high standards for governing it, believing that they would only be able to keep up that unique identity if they actually lived up to those standards.
Well, that's absolutely true. Now, everybody knows who studied any American history that we've had various scandals, financial scandals in Washington, Teapot Dome and so forth over the years. And there have been people with their hands in the federal treasury and bribing officials and doing things like that. But it has not been as systemic as it has for the last 25 or 30 years. And this is almost all developed since I was in office in the 70s and 80s. Very few, if any, of the senators I served with in either party in that period walked out the door and became lobbyists. I wouldn't say it was beneath them, but they did not feel that it was ethical or moral to convert a title given them by their voters into cash in their own pocket. And that's what the lobbyists are doing today.
You make two points in tracing how we got to this point. One is that this ultimately happened in the middle of the 20th century onward and widened that gap between conscience and corruption. But you also make the link to the rise of the national security state.
Well, it was. We're all familiar with former general and President Dwight Eisenhower's warning as he left office about developing a military-industrial complex. In 1947, Congress passed the National Security Act, which created a permanent Department of Defense, a CIA, an Air Force, and a National Security Council. And from that day forward, we have been, in effect, a national security state that lasted 40-some years during the Cold War. And now it's migrated over to a war on terrorism and intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan. On top of that was what I call the surveillance state, the creation of an empire of intelligence services that not only spied on the Soviets and various other countries, including allies of ours, but also on vast numbers of American citizens. And then we also left 800 military bases around the world, so we would have a military presence here and there at great expense to the federal treasury. And then finally, as I point out, the special interest state was built on top of that so that giant corporations would get pieces of that pie.
And again, specifically for the examples that you just cited, how does that go to widen that gap between conscious and corruption? Talk about the link between the two.
Well, if you were a member of the Senate or House of Representatives, you have 24 hours in the day, and let's say you've 12 of those are in your office. You have a choice every 15 to 30 minutes of who you're going to see. Now, you can either see the Johnsons from your home state, or you can see the lobbyists who just delivered $250,000 in campaign contributions. Who do you think gets priority? That's what's going on. This is not illegal corruption. This is legal corruption. It's not against the law, and it's certainly not against the law since the infamous Citizen United decision, which in effect legalized this corruption among corporate interests. And that's what's disturbing people. Back in, I sound like an old timer, but I guess I am. When I served, virtually any Coloradan that came to Washington or who wanted to see me in Colorado could see me. It didn't matter whether they'd given me a dime in campaign contribution. And by the way, campaign costs were a tiny fraction of what they are today. So it's the sense that, as I said earlier, that the system is in Washington is awash in money, that to participate in that system, you have to make large contributions, and those contributions get you access to the policymakers and the candidates.
And I will give myself the opportunity to age myself as well, but when the first presidential campaign I ever worked on was yours in 1984, and you were talking about and had written a book about these new ideas that you had and were coming out and speaking about much of what you're talking about in this book. And I guess I'm curious as to how much of this did you see coming and how much of it really was a degradation and a surprise along the way of the last several decades?
I think as I, well, first of all, belatedly, thank you for your help in those days.
Thank you.
I think when I was contemplating a second national race and people putting together a campaign began to talk about the amount of money that was needed for the media primarily, I began to be very, very uneasy about it because it was several zeros more than it had been even 3 years before that. And then second, an incident happened in my office even earlier, I think late 70s. A group of Coloradans came in, brought in by the Washington representative of their organization, whatever it was, and we had a nice discussion about their problems. And they left, and my administrative assistant came in with an envelope. And I opened it, and it was a check for $2,000 for my AD reelection campaign. So I sent him running down the hall to catch up with them to give them the money back. Apparently, as early as the late 70s, the word was getting around that if you wanted to see a member of Congress, you had to pay some money. I was appalled. I was literally shaken that that idea was beginning to permeate our government. It scared me to death. So I think I date all this about that time. Late 70s, early 80s, and then well into the 90s. And now we're down to, even though there is an army of people running on the Republican side, we're down to two leading families, one of which has been on a national campaign four times, and another one that's been on a national ticket or campaign eight or nine times. And this is not healthy for this country.
So you do in the book pretty much present a manifesto of what we can do about it. And in our remaining time, tell us of what it is that we as a nation, especially given the choices that we perhaps will have at the ballot box next year, what we can do about it.
Well, first of all, we can at home, I think we ought to have a law against members of Congress going into lobbying immediately. You can have a bar of a year or two or five or ten, but they shouldn't walk out the door and cash in for big dollars. That's step number one. Change the Supreme Court and overturn Citizens United. That's going to take some time, obviously, and some justices who understand how wrong that decision was. And reinstitute campaign finance reform, if you can, post-Citizens United. Another McCain-Feingold, which actually came out of a bill that I introduced even before then. There are ways that we can stop this flow of money into campaigns. And then I would say a vigilant press that asks the right questions, not obsessing about Donald Trump and his statements on Mexico, but finding out from these candidates their position on trade, their position on what national security means in the 21st century. And finally, in conducting our foreign policy, acting according to our own principles. For those of us who've had an opportunity to travel the world, we see the difference from abroad of what America claims for itself and what people actually see us doing. We preach democracy, we go to war for democracy, and yet 50% of the American people don't even take the trouble to vote. People around the world know this. They also know the impact of special interests and the kind of thing this book is about, that if you're rich and powerful, you get special treatment in the government. That's a corruption that people know about around the world.
30 years ago, when you were running for president of the United States, and as you were talking about the Donald Trump issue you're calling for a vigilant press, but the press then 30 years ago was out for the scandal, and they're still out for the scandal. What do we do about that?
Well, I'd suggest those in the media ask themselves that question. I've over the course of those years read many editorials and journal articles and others from people in the media saying, why do we do what we do? I don't know. I've had reporters ask me that. Why do we in the media behave the way we do? It's the most ridiculous question I've ever heard. You'll get somebody honest enough to say ratings, but I would think the Clinton experience should have laid that to rest. Even as people in the media and the readership obsessed over the Clinton situation, his popularity remained high. So it means that just because people find something interesting, and exposure of people's private life may or may not be interesting, certainly as a president it is, they don't necessarily think it's important.
Gary Hart's new book is The Republic of Conscience. It is published by Blue Rider Press. Senator Hart, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, and thank you for your time.
Again, Gary Hart's new book is The Republic of Conscience. It is published by Blue Rider Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.